Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up for Monday, January 26th. My name is Magnus Teeval. Joining me in the studio today is
Peter R.H.
And we have a bunch of good stuff for you lined up on the show today. We have a report about, last week the BC government rolled back on its drug decriminalization program after, it was a pilot project and they're backing away from that now. So we have a report just on what are the implications of that reversal in policy. We also have a report about a series of workshops for tenants, but also for landlords, just about their rights. So everybody knows what their rights are, but also their obligations. We're going to talk a bit about Peter.
Well, you emailed me about this, so I'm going to go over the trucker convoy, because you were saying there's a recent court decision that the government of Canada went a bit too far in some aspects.
Yeah, there is an appeal. There's a court case against what the government had done there, the actions they took, saying it was too far, too extensive and didn't really constitute a national emergency. And they lost that in court, and then the government appealed it, and that appeal has come down, and the government has lost it again. So it's sort of I think it's a bit of an interesting story about how we deal with these things, situations like this. In Canada, but also it makes a bit of an interesting contrast to the U.S., where Trump is for so many of the things he's trying to do or doing, you know, he claims it's some sort of national emergency. And as far as I can tell so far, there doesn't seem to be any sort of check and balance as to whether that claim is legitimate or
well,
not.
Well, he is starting a national emergency. He is creating it.
Yeah.
That's what's happening. There was no national emergency until he created them. And now he's got quite a few of them.
Yeah. We have all those stories, plus Bird Note. We'll bring you some good music and a bunch more. So thank you for joining us here on Speak Up this Monday morning. So a bit of a chat about the news. Holy moly, there's a lot of stuff that happened this week just in the international affairs. There was the two things we've got extensive reports on, the BC government backing away from decriminalization, their pilot project and not. There's the court case that we're also going to be talking about later. There's also all the things happening internationally. Mark Carney there was the Davos Forum, a collective with all the world leaders and business leaders sort of gathering together as they do every year, and Mark Carney used it as an opportunity to make a speech about the state of the rules-based order, as it's been called, since the Second World War.
Yeah.
you look like you had something to say about that.
It's okay. Basically, it is. One thing about the World Economic Forum now, this is the first year, it's not what the critics of it have been critical of it. Now it's more of that they're dealing with the United States.
Yeah.
That's what the World Economic Forum, this is the first year last year I guess was a bit of that, but we didn't really have the ramifications of it.
Yeah.
Now there's something called donut theory of
Let's get back to that in a second.
Okay.
I want
to talk about something else. Go ahead.
Yeah, so then, of course, there is also the whole Greenland situation.
Which kind of fizzled out, didn't it? A little bit.
Kind of. You know, I think Europe in particular, you know, just stood up to Trump, and he kind of backed off when he realized he wasn't going to get it. So we can talk a bit about that. And then, of course, there's the whole thing happening in with ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement actions in Minnesota, and particularly in Minneapolis, which resulted in another death of a protester this weekend. So we'll get to all those topics briefly. So let's talk about Mark Carney's speech a little bit. The basic thrust of his speech was that what we've called the rules-based order since the Second World War has come to an end. And the idea of the rules-based order was that, you know, rather than everything being a contest of might, you know, that there would be rules around international relations, international law, that, you know, constrain powers both great and small. And, you know, his observation and what he was talking about in his speech was that, you know, with particular, I think the particular change is, you know, the actions of Trump in the United States is that that rules-based order is over. You could say that really, you know, the Russian invasion of Ukraine also marked one of the ending facets of that, because that's the first time sort of that two major fairly first world powers, but really almost any, you know, situation where one country, you know, had aggressively invaded another without at least some framework of sort of acceptance, you know, from the UN or whatever, because you can also always point to the U.S. invasion of Iraq with its allies, but they got, you know, a motion through at the UN to approve that. So that was one of the first things. But I think the other thing that was interesting about Carney's comments was his comment that, you know, on some level, you know, the rules-based order had always been a bit of a fiction. I mean, it definitely was operating, but whenever it really suited the great powers, whether that was the U.S. or the Soviet Union and then Russia or China, they could always kind of do what they wanted. And the other thing I would say is it always sort of, you know, there was definitely an in-group and out-group of countries that got the most benefit from it. You know, first world economies were sort of the in-group, and they got to the benefit of a rules-based order, and a lot of other countries didn't. And, you know, when they stepped out of line, they got pushed around and bombed and many other things of you know, being coerced by the big powers.
Mm. Well, as far as the World Economic Forum goes, I'd like to bring up, it seems unrelated, there was this theory of urbanization in the United States in the 70s and in the 80s. It's called the donut theory of urbanization. The thing is that the downtown core becomes a bad area. So not only do people live outside of this downtown core, but businesses start having their main businesses outside of it. So the city becomes this donut.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the World Economic Forum has become a donut because arguably they were saying we are for a globalization. Well, the main hole now is the United States.
Right.
So now we have sort of a donut phenomenality of globalization because Donald Trump has bucked the trend. And so now we got like a basically just donut now.
Well, that's an interesting analogy because, you know, the other part of the United States not becoming or sort of becoming a little more economically isolationist is that other countries, and this is sort of what is the policy of Canada, have tried to, are starting to strengthen their ties with other countries besides the United States. You know, in the case of Canada, where we have something like 75% of our exports go to the United States, and if the U.S. isn't a reliable partner anymore, we're looking for, you know, access and agreements with many other countries, you know. And the government here has, they've just been to China, signed some agreements there. They're going to be going to a bunch of other places, to India and elsewhere, to try and create and shore up agreements to diversify trade. So, and I think probably you'll find that Europe and most other countries are doing the same thing. So we're getting this strengthening of the donut with the, as you say, right?
Yeah.
There's going to be this web of other relationships working around what some might say is the problem of the United States.
Well, sort of the argument over the years was that, you know, they're creating a one-world government. But that was, you would have had to have a president of the United States. I guess it was seen by, not so much me, but other reactionaries, that Bill Clinton, Obama, and Joe Biden were going to usher that in. You know, but the thing is now you got like the donut, because the World Economic Forum now is just the meeting was about dealing with the rest of the world, or not quite. I don't think a lot of third world happen to be there,
mm-hmm.
but how they're going to be doing with the United States.
Right.
And the other thing, I think there's kind of three entities now. It's the United States. It's kind of what is represented by the World Economic Forum, and actually BRICS, because yeah. BRICS deals with, well, Brazil is not really a third world country, but...
Not anymore.
Well, it kind of went up and down. It was better a few years ago. But no, and that sort of with the funding coming from mainland China, I don't think Russia is mainly funding a lot of the third world, but it's mainland China, and that's going away from the World Bank, the IMF, mm-hmm. for a lot of these countries. So it's sort of like three entities now.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that I would contend this is like a three-year phenomenality, because with Trump, I don't think it's going to be here 3 years, because I don't think the Republicans are going to get in. I mean, the midterms are coming. We don't know how he's going to kind of make it harder for certain segments of the population to vote during the midterms. But I can't really see a Republican president being elected 3 years from now. So it's going to maybe, this is just a, who knows? I mean, FIFA are maybe going to learn their lesson or something. I mean, it's sort of like Germany 1945.
Yeah,
maybe we won't do this again. I don't know. Which they haven't. There you go.
All right. So, also, it was at Davos that the sort of end game of the whole Greenland saga that's been dominating the news for a week or so played out with Donald Trump insisting that, you know, they needed Greenland for national security, that they were going to get it one way or the other, that, you know, initially early in last week, you know, when this was first coming up, sort of making the suggestion that they would use force if they needed to. European powers responded by sending a small number of troops, mostly a sort of advance party for sending more troops to Greenland. You know, ostensibly to defend it, but I think also just to make a symbolic gesture. A lot of heavy pressure on Denmark, which Greenland is part of the sovereign territory of as an autonomous region. And then it seemed, you know, as the various European governments and powers, the ones who sent some troops and others, sort of made it clear that they weren't going to just make a deal with Trump. He, you know, first he sort of said that, okay, well, I'm not going to use, you know, force to take this. And then the whole thing kind of fizzled out, as I think he probably realized that he'd made a big mistake thinking he could just sort of bully his way into getting it handed over.
Yeah, it was pretty idiotic and stupid. All across. I mean, it's. They haven't had the American bases like they once had for years.
Yeah.
I mean, I think they should ask all the American bases to leave myself. No, yeah. Really, because it's. The other thing is that with the Canadian military, a lot of what we do is just reinforcement in the United States. It's not an independent military.
Yeah.
And now they're asking the that person, the ambassador of the United States for Canada, he's saying, oh, we have to have this certain jet. We can't get it somewhere else or all of this. I mean, in a past show, I said, we shouldn't even have a military. Because the thing is that they'd say, well, we need. What if they come over, Russia or mainland China? Well, Trump seems to be collaborating with Russia. He's part of that peace forum or something.
Yeah.
I mean, and I never really kind of bought into the Russia collusion, but it sort of kind of think maybe it was true because he's constantly collaborating, doesn't want to what the Ukrainian president does want to back him up. So
the whole Greenland situation sort of ended with a discussion negotiation between Trump and the head of NATO, which was a sort of interesting because, of course, you know, the head of NATO is the head of NATO and wouldn't have any authority to make decisions on behalf of the Danish government. But no details have been released about that. And I suspect that what ended up happening was whether it was just explained to him or sort of he was convinced that he was getting a sweet deal by getting exactly what the U.S. always had in Greenland. There's a treaty from, I think it's 1951, between Denmark and the United States that gives the U.S. extensive permission and rights to establish bases and use it as a place for military operations and basing. They have a small establishment now, but they've had a whole air base and a lot of other stuff, and they have the right to really expand into that. And I suspect that when Trump said, "Oh well, we just negotiate," it's a bit of a way to climb back down without admitting he just made a fool of himself.
Well, yes. Hopefully he'll die in a few months. There's been reports of that. But of course, then you got J.D. Vance. I don't know. He's kind of a weaker will, I think, but I don't know. It's not a good situation.
Yeah. And then the last thing is, you know, what's been going on in Minneapolis with the protests and another shooting of a protester this week on Saturday. There's like five different views of that incident from different angles of bystanders filming it, and it's. Have you seen the?
I've seen them. Isn't one of the contentions that the person that got shot, was carrying a gun at the time?
Yeah, that's part of the issue because he was carrying a gun, but he had a permit to open carry. I guess Minnesota is an open carry state where you can get a permit and you can walk around with a gun on your hip.
And he never drew it out.
He never drew it. And that's interesting because, you know, I mean, as soon as this happened, you know, the head of Homeland Security, the head of the Attorney General, you know, whatever, Kristi Noem, who's head of Homeland Security, you know, immediately comes out and declares that this person was a domestic terrorist, just like they said about the other one a few weeks earlier, you know, and made the claim that, you know, there's some official source made the claim that he'd been brandishing the gun or coming at with the gun. But, you know, none of that's held up by the video. He never takes the gun out. In the video, you can see somebody, as they're sort of tussling with him, you know, grabs the gun in the holster and removes it and takes off.
But they grab his gun.
Yeah. they take it off him, which is still in his holster, still attached to his hip, not in his hand. And it's after that happens that the first shot gets fired. And in the end, apparently 11 shots were fired by two different officers, which, to me, I'm not an expert in this thing, seems kind of crazy.
Well, I think I'm against ICE. It seems like they're... No, one thing about... So the law in Minnesota is that you can... Well, what's the exact term? Carry?
Open carry.
Open carry. Now, California during the 60s had that same thing.
Yeah.
You could be walking down the street with a... Maybe not a machine gun, but a type of a gun around you.
Yeah.
And Ronald Reagan, as governor of California, stopped it because the Black Panthers were doing it.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting that he gets tied up with... Well, he's for the NRA and all this, but interesting that he kind of brought that down in California. No, we don't want people in general to carry guns, but in Minnesota they have that now. So anyway, that's interesting.
All right. BC government backed off on its policy or the pilot project on decriminalization of harder drugs, part of an effort to try and cut back against the toxic drug epidemic by in theory at least providing safer ways for people to access and consume drugs. Almost from the beginning, that pilot project met a lot of opposition, and now the government is canceling that program, and I guess they'll come up with something new. But stuff like, you know, changes like that, you know, comes with consequences. And this report from CICK in Smithers digs into that, takes a bit of a deep dive into the consequences of backing off on decriminalization.
This is CICK News. As of January 31st, BC's three-year pilot project decriminalizing small amounts of illegal drugs will come to an end. The province says enforcement practices won't change, but critics argue that the policy failed to deliver meaningful treatment access or clear guidance on the ground. I reached out to the RCMP for comment, but they were not making themselves available to speak to me by my deadline. I was able to speak with Skeena MLA and official opposition critic for mental health, addictions, and housing supports, MLA Claire Rate, about what the end of decriminalization means for northern communities, concerns around stigma and public safety, and what her party says is needed next to address the toxic drug crisis, particularly in the north. I pressed MLA Rate to give me concrete examples, as the opposition party has been highly critical of the decriminalization project. Apologies for the sound quality of this interview. The phone call that I used, I had technical issues, and MLA Rate had to call me back on a phone that didn't have great reception.
I'm the MLA for Skeena and the official opposition critic for mental health, addiction, and housing supports.
Okay. So could we just start off January 31st? It'll be the end of the decriminalization program. What are your thoughts on the end of this program?
Just because this pilot project is ending, there were no clear guidelines from the ministry or the government as to what that effectively changes on the ground. They're not making any changes to the way that law enforcement handles it. They're not making any changes to the way first responders handle anything. Those working within mental health and addiction, the only announcement that they had to pair with any of this was the expansion of a phone line that already last year was announced as it was supposed to be then available to anyone in the province, and it evidently was not. So now they've expanded that so it's available to anyone in the province at some point in this year, and that's pretty much it.
Yeah, and I did want to actually touch on some of those points with you. Is your party, are you concerned with how this will need to increase police intervention in communities for people who are in possession of 2.5 grams of substance or lower?
I don't think this is going to change anything effectively on the ground with the way that law enforcement handles simple possession charges for personal use. This pilot project, law enforcement was already using their discretion in these cases. That's been going on for a very long time. It's been well understood for a long time that substance use and addiction problems are a health issue. And obviously there needs to be discretion used, because if it crosses that boundary of it being simply a health issue and it crosses into a public safety issue, that's when discretion should be used. But the problem with the way that this experiment was rolled out was effectively the outcome from this experiment was just normalizing drug use in public and almost encouraging it, normalizing it, and disincentivizing recovery and treatment. And that was the problem I had with this from the beginning. Law enforcement was already very capable and was exercising that in using their judgment on a case-by-case basis. That this was not necessary if that was the intent behind this pilot. That's what they're claiming now, is this was to incentivize treatment and to normalize that and to remove any criminal element to getting help and to make sure that people didn't feel scared to reach out for help. But treatment was never criminalized. It's the exact opposite. And I know that because I've lived through it. In 2011, I went to treatment for a drug problem, because I knew at that point in my life I was struggling and that going to treatment was the only option available to me that actually removed any element of criminality and any element of me being at risk of hurting myself, of death. It's just such a false premise, because that was never the reason behind it.
And is your position as critic for mental health addictions and obviously housing support? We know how obviously those three go hand in hand, because if you don't have a safe place to be, to live, that you have this constant stress of your life of what the next day is going to look like, what today is even going to look like. So for your party then, and honestly, if you don't want to talk too much about your experience, but what about voluntary versus involuntary care? How is your party going to work with this announcement and then pivot to suggest a treatment that your party can actually stand behind and that you yourself stand behind?
Yeah, for sure. I'm never uncomfortable talking about my experiences. And so for me, we've been looking at voluntary versus involuntary treatment. The biggest distinction here is that we still have many British Columbians, thousands of British Columbians that want to access treatment voluntarily that haven't been able to, because of long wait lists, because there's not enough investment in publicly funded beds. Even the ones that are publicly funded aren't funded at 100% of the rate. It varies from health authority to health authority, but in some cases, they're only being funded to about 50 to 70% of what the actual cost is. So the providers have to prioritize private pay clients to be able to just keep the doors open. So we're in a situation right now where not only do we have thousands of British Columbians that voluntarily would like to access treatment, but because this problem has gotten so out of hand that they have to pivot to involuntary treatment. They really have no choice left in the matter, simply because we're seeing everywhere that there are more and more people that are permanently brain injured, that are struggling with severe mental health challenges on top of the fact that they have a substance use problem. Our mental health system has been incredibly far behind what we need it to be. We do not have universal health care access, because we do not have universal access to mental health support. That's why involuntary treatment has become so necessary at this point.
And I realize that obviously too, that this is more than this is obviously more than just a toxic drug or even a supply issue. That's obviously at the heart of a lot of these deaths here. But one thing that I did want to just to press you about was how then your government will address the importance of community addiction services, but also when we're looking at care facilities, whether they're voluntary or involuntary. We know that the North is overrun, and a lot of people, these are some public health nurses or social workers, and then also people that I've spoken to who, when they are suffering a mental health addiction and they've experienced an overdose, what happens is that they're actually taken out of the community so often. And I am speaking to you from Smithers, that they're taken out of the community and typically they go to Prince George, but that it's so important to still stay grounded in community. So with your experience, what would your party then suggest as a way to actually continue and even support a grounding in your community rather than being removed? And then a lot of times people come back, but their community hasn't changed, but they have. How would you address that?
Yeah, so I would say the first part of it is the premise I don't necessarily agree with, because I think I'm a really good example.